Hi everyone, this is September 15th, 2019, and it is episode 196 of At Percussion. This is Carly Vigna, and I'm here today with co-host Ben Charles.
Hi Ben.
And Casey Cangelosi.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
Casey, I think you might have just walked in the door coming from the North Carolina Percussion Symposium. How was that?
It was great. Yeah, thanks for asking. It was so good. And this is only their third year doing it. And they've had like a big guest artist every time. They had Shi Yi Wu. They've had Michael Burrett. And yeah, just very, very impressed with everything I saw and the students. And there was this kid there who's 14 years old. And during my clinic, we got into this cool conversation about avant-garde music and composition just in general, but also, you know, really, really difficult, challenging music. It's really dissonant. And he knew Stravinsky, he knew Schoenberg, he knew, and this isn't me saying these names and him like nodding. No, he said these names. He said, so when I listen to composers like Schoenberg and that you know, progressed into things like Ferneyhough, like he knew Ferneyhough. And I was like, wait a minute. I said in the clinic, how old are you? He's 14. I think I embarrassed him a little bit. I didn't mean to, but I was really, really impressed by just, yeah, everything there and the other clinicians. And yeah, I don't know about you all, but when you go to these things, do you try to see as many other clinicians as possible? Do you like, I know some people are, they just don't have the bandwidth for it. They're maybe a little burnt out or something, which I can totally understand. I've been there, but I learn a lot. Like, I know generally you agree with what the other clinicians say, but I just learn a lot by, I pick up quotes, especially, you know, I feel like, okay, that's an opinion I agree with, but they said it better than I ever could. And now I get to tell my students like, hey, this doesn't just come from me. This comes from the Phantom Regiment Tech, you know? It just adds more weight to your opinion, you know?
Yes, I totally agree. And like, I remember I did one a couple years ago in Illinois, and like Gwen Deese was one of the clinicians. So that was a spectacular experience. Casey, who puts that on? Who does the North Carolina one? It's not, is it their PAS chapter?
So it's not. So in fact, I pulled it up because I wanted to just thank them. But Kuntal Shah was one of the hosts, and he teaches at this Enoll High School and Greenhope High School, and actually a JMU alum, which might have been why he reached out to me first. But Casey Segolas Lamp is one of the other hosts that teaches there. So yeah, they're just the drumline instructors there. You know, they are the percussion instructors there. They managed to put this whole thing together. And 120 kids were there this time.
Wow. It a multi-day event or one day?
One day, yeah. But a full day. Yeah, winners concert, competition, clinics all day. There's little breakout sessions, little 30-minute timed rotations where I was in a room with Nathan Daughtry and myself talking about composition. Students would come in and ask questions about composition or publishing or whatever. And yeah, I was really impressed.
That's so cool. That's great to hear. Our guest today is Dr. Yunju Alice Pan. She currently serves as an adjunct professor at University of North Alabama alongside our friend Tracy Wiggins. Alice is an award-winning performer and educator who has performed with Ju Percussion Group, with Gordon Stout, with Gwen Deese, and many, many more. She won the 2016 Australia Marimba Competition and also the 2016 Taiwan International Percussion Championship in Marimba, Vibraphone, and Chamber Ensemble. It's so great to have you with us today, Alice. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me here.
Oh, welcome. So I know you just recently relocated, right?
Right. 2 weeks ago.
Well, how are you settling in Alabama there?
It's getting better. I moved into an apartment a couple days ago. Now I have a bed and I have a house to live in, which is nice.
That makes a big difference.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. It was pretty frustrating to just live in the hotel.
Well, yeah, I can imagine, especially long term. So how's the position going? Are you settled into the school year and the semester?
Yeah, it's going well. I had, I already have 2 weeks of teaching, and everything's went pretty smooth so far.
That's good. Good. What are your responsibilities there this semester?
This semester, I mainly teach keyboard lessons. I do have a couple students that's having 4-hour lesson with me that I have to teach not only keyboard, but also all the percussions. And from next semester, I'm going to have my own percussion ensemble and then building a percussion ensemble program.
Cool. Yeah. So when students study with you, are they seeing you every week to work on marimba, or do they kind of rotate through?
Yeah, they see me every week for most of them for a half hour.
Oh, okay.
There are a couple that's 1 hour.
Nice. Well, I'm happy for you with the new position. It sounds very good.
Thank you.
You know, I wanted to tell everybody, I first met Alice at the McCormick Marimba Festival in person. I think we knew each other on Facebook before that. And it was back in January, and I remember she played a beautiful solo recital, and I'm so happy that I was able to hear it, because it was one of those things, like Casey was saying, like, you perform, and then you just try to watch as much of everything else happening as you can. I think you were not long after me and my students. But yeah. one of the pieces that I've been thinking about since I heard you play it, that it keeps coming back, was the Ox Suite, Three Songs for a Singing Marimbus by Josh Oxford. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that piece.
Yeah, so this piece, Josh Oxford is my friend from Ithaca College, where I did a master's degree. And he was a percussionist, and then he had some accident and he can't play, so he transferred to composition. So one day he just listened to me singing and decided to write something for marimba and singing. And at first, it's only the first movement, which is called Afterwards. And after the premiere of that one, and he decided to write another 2 songs to make it a suit.
So were you doing a lot of singing while playing marimba before that? Is that something that developed kind of naturally for you?
No, that's the first piece that I did. I do like singing a lot. I actually took 1 year off from after bachelor degree to master degree to sing in the pub. So, and then after I go to the Ithaca College, we met and we decided to do these kind of things. So that's my first piece.
Wow, cool. Mm-hmm. And have you done others since then?
Yeah, I transcribed some pop song that my friend wrote from Taiwan. And I'm also, there's going to be more coming up soon.
Cool, I look forward to hearing about it. Casey, I think you have something.
I was gonna go ask back to your job there with our buddy Tracy Wiggins. And I think it's not too mysterious how people get full-time professor jobs. There's a job posting, you apply for the posting, you submit your stuff, there's rounds, interviews, etc. But a lot of times adjunct positions are, in a way, harder. Well, they're more mysterious how you get them. And because sometimes they do a job announcement, sometimes they don't. Sometimes you can just kind of choose who you hire. The rules are very different. A lot of times someone won't move to a town. You said you moved, this is why I thought of this. You moved to this new place for this job. And a lot of times they'll just hire someone who's close by. There's kind of a whole, you know, gray area with how that works.
So the connection is super important. I did a performance and clinic 2 or 3 years ago at UNA. And then after that, I keep in touch with Dr. Wiggins. And this summer, he just called me and asked me if I'm interested in doing this. So at that time, I was just graduated and I have nothing to do trying to find a job. So I immediately said, yeah, I'll do that and I'll move there and see what's happening next.
So did he kind of put out, tell everyone there was a need and then you responded, or did he come straight to you first? How did that conversation happen?
He comes straight to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what about Ben and Carly?
Mine was luck.
this is Boca Raton, right?
Yeah, well, it's kind of that saying, was that luck is when opportunity meets preparation. When I was going to Miami, there was another school, Florida Atlantic University, about an hour north, that had another Miami grad student that had been teaching there. His name was Cliff Sutton, and he won a Fulbright scholarship to go study in Latin America. And so Cliff left, and the band director there called up my teacher, Svet, at Miami and said, "I need a person. Who do you have?" And Carly had already gotten the TA spot at Miami, and I didn't have a TA. So good for Carly. But yeah, and so Svet said, "Well, I've got this guy that doesn't have a teaching assistantship and could sort of use one." So it was sort of an unofficial teaching assistantship for me. And it was kind of cool because I actually got to keep it when I graduated, which a lot of people get these teaching assistantships. Then obviously when you graduate, you lose it. So yeah, it actually worked out well in my favor to not get the teaching assistantship in a way.
Yeah, the job is better than a deal at school probably, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably so.
In the long run, yeah. Yeah, you know, my situation, my first adjunct position was at FIU, and it's really similar, I think, to what Alice's experience was, that I had contacts there, and they reached out to me and said, "Hey, would you like to join our faculty?" And I said, "Yeah, that's exactly the direction I want to go." I think it ranges a lot. I've at New World School of the Arts, which is a school that I just started at, this fall, which I'm thrilled about. I actually went and had an interview and played an audition. Like, I played a short solo recital. I taught the students. I had a demonstration. And that's, you know, a similar number of hours, but just structured differently. So I think it varies a lot. Sometimes they post, sometimes they don't.
Cool. Well, Alice, as a follow-up to that, I had a question for you. And many of us, certainly Carly and me, are teaching at schools where I am the percussion department. I'm the only one. Faculty meetings for the percussion department are very easy. When you're team teaching, which I know Casey does at JMU with Caleb and Alice, obviously, with Tracy at UNA, how do you divide up the team teaching? Especially, I don't know Tracy's playing very well, but I can imagine that just based on your training, Alice and Tracy are very different players. And in my experience, like North Texas, where I did my undergrad, all the teachers have a very similar philosophy. I mean, Mark Ford and Christopher Dean go way, way, way back. So I never found any conflicting information between lessons. So how do you reconcile those differences?
At UNA, we actually have more percussion instructors, and some of them I haven't even seen it yet. But mostly Tracy organized everything. And my responsibility is mainly in keyboard playing. And there's another adjunct that's teaching younger, like freshmen and sophomore. And there's, I think, a drum set instructor and a world percussion instructor. So all of us has a different area, but we all report back to Tracy. He's like very respectful for our teaching style. He doesn't really like intrude it too much.
Yeah,
he trusts you guys, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's one thing that's very nice is I know, like, if I was teaching with Carly or Casey, who I both know very well at this point, I know there are big differences between all of our playing. But I don't think anyone's right or wrong. And I would certainly be receptive to a student if a student picked Carly's way of playing something on snare drum. I wouldn't be offended by that.
Have you ever team taught a student, like you and the other teacher together at the same time, working on the same piece?
At the same time?
Yeah.
That's too much.
Seems like a good way to get your teachers to fight.
Well, so I was going to say the best time I've ever had doing that and the most comfortable I've ever been with another teacher is with Pius Chang, because when I visited his school, he said, like, yeah, teach my lessons with me. And so I did for not too many lessons, like a couple lessons, but it was, yeah.
You guys
was,
just make jokes the whole time?
Well, that was the thing. I think we taught a couple really good lessons too. Like, it was really, yeah, it was really fun.
Can we get those students on the podcast?
See what they, yeah, see there. You're only hearing one side of the story.
Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say something. Have you learned all Tracy's little nicknames, like Twiggy and maybe since he's Dr. Wiggins, Dwiggins, I don't know. I've heard all these things before. Gene Kaczynski tells me these things.
No, I never heard about that.
Not yet? Okay, you can implement that.
Maybe soon.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe come up with your own nicknames.
Oh, yeah.
You can tell us. We'll talk about it on the podcast.
Okay. I'll think about it. I'll let you know.
Well, it sounds like the moral of the story here is that a lot of these jobs just come from connections. And it's, of course, that's always such a big thing to talk about. We talk about like the big networking word, but networking doesn't matter if you aren't, talented. Like Tracy wouldn't have reached out to Alice if he didn't know she could do the job and if he couldn't trust her and didn't really, admire her playing and teaching and personality and all those things. So yes, networking, but also just confidence,
Well, and it goes back to like the thing that I'm sure we all heard a ton when we were students and that we share with our students is you never know who you're going to meet and make an impression on anywhere at any time. It was a couple of years ago, you go and give a class and then in a few years it turns into something major, like you moved to Alabama. So it's the perfect example. And I love seeing those because I love to tell my students, like, when you go to this festival, you want to be really prepared because you don't know who you're going to meet at that festival that in 10 years could be playing with the Met or could be, have a really prominent chamber group. You never know. Right. So it's awesome. It's awesome to see.
One of the coolest stories like that I've ever heard is there was a trombone professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, which is in Richmond, where I grew up. And I was talking to him and he said, yeah, when I was in high school, I would go to these jazz camps and there was this guy named Winton that was just burning on trumpet, which obviously turned out to be Marsalis. But that, never know.
This guy.
Yeah.
Well, Ben, I think you have something to share with us on Gordon Stout.
Yeah, so since Alice is one of Gordon's students, I thought I'd give the book report on Gordon Stout and then we could ask Alice about studying with Gordon. Gordon was a previous podcast guest, which I should have written down his episode number off the top of my head. I don't know why I feel like it was 56, but I'm probably totally wrong on that. But you can find it on our new Podbean podcast site. but anyway, so the quick background on Gordon Stout. I wanted to give a side note. When I was doing my research for this on Gordon's website, I found an article. It was actually a transcript of a PASIC panel discussion called Rosewood One Last Breath that I think Gordon was the moderator for. And like I said, it's a transcript so you can see what everyone said. They had Doug DeMauro, Mark Ford, Shi-Yi Wu, Ron Samuels, and a few other people involved in marimba manufacturing. Fantastic stuff if you're interested in that rosewood preservation topic that we've talked about a couple of times. Also for Nana Meza, I remember was in there. But anyway, so on to the Gordon Stout info here. Gordon was born in 1952 in Wichita, Kansas. Both of his parents were professional musicians. His father was a horn player and his mother was a flute player in the Kansas City Philharmonic. Gordon says he recalls listening to classical music on road trips as a kid, and he states that he learned all the Beethoven symphonies by ear before he even knew who Beethoven was. In 1954, his family moved to Elmhurst, Illinois, where his father played in the Chicago Symphony for 6 years. Then after that, in 1960, his family moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where his father began his 28-year tenure as professor of French horn at the University of Michigan. His father took him all around the university when he was about 8 or 9 years old and introduced him to all of the professors, and Gordon chose James Salmon and the marimba as his preferred professor and instrument. And so he says, I chose Jim Salmon because he was a very nice man who was easy to be around, and I chose the marimba because the first time I hit a bar, I thought the sound was just incredible. He started composing for the marimba during his senior year of high school. He wrote two pieces, Reverie and Elegy, which I've heard of. I don't think I've ever actually heard either one performed, as study pieces for the Fissinger Suite for Marimba, which is one of those early marimba works. And then after he studied with Salmon for 10 years growing up, when he went to college, he decided it was time for a new chapter. So he decided to attend the Eastman School of Music, where he studied with John Beck. And he recalls learning by watching some older students, including a couple guys named Bill Kahn and Bob Becker, who would later become members of the percussion group Nexus. While at Eastman, he studied with he studied composition with Joseph Schwantner, Samuel Adler, and Warren Benson. Interestingly, Stout had written a book of etudes, and the ninth one didn't really fit in the book. And so Warren Benson said, well, how about you take this one? It sounds kind of Mexican. Why don't you write another one like this and call it Two Mexican Dances? And so the Two Mexican Dances are not at all authentic Mexican music. And in fact, Gordon didn't even mean for them to sound Mexican. That was Warren Benson's doing. So he says Warren's to blame for that one. He finished at Eastman in 1976 with a bachelor's degree in percussion performance and a master's degree in composition. And he began his illustrious performance career at the first ever PASIC convention in 1976, where I know he played the first Mexican dance, I think, among other things. But Bill Mersch talked about people saw Gordon play this first Mexican dance and it just blew their minds how difficult it was, which by today's standards, obviously, it's not too bad. He began also around this time teaching at St. Mary's College in Maryland for 3 years before he moved to Ithaca College, where he taught for 38 years and served as the chair of the Performance Studies Department. I can't remember the exact dates on that, but that was toward the end of his career. He retired from Ithaca College in May 2019, and his former students include Dane Richeson, Tom Burritt, Michael Burritt, Naoko Takada, Kevin Bobo, Valerie Naranjo, and of course, Alice, our guest today. He was involved in that 1986 NEA Commission concert with Lee Howard Stevens and William Mersch that we've discussed a couple times on the podcast. He was a jury member at the first and second Lee Howard Stevens International Marimba competitions in 1995 and 1998. He has over 5 dozen compositions to date, one of which called Bassicata that I got to give the world premiere for, which was pretty cool. I went up to Ithaca, played that with my buddy Kate, and Gordon dedicated that piece to Kate and me, so I'm very, very proud of that one. But some of his other compositions include some standards in the percussion repertoire, especially the marimba repertoire, including Two Mexican Dances, Rumble Strips, Sedimental Structures, Astral Dance, and Wood That Sings, which is one of my favorite two mallet pieces ever for marimba, and I think it's way underplayed. He's appeared at over a dozen PASIC conventions. He has over 20 recording credits to his name as a performer or composer. One of those recordings is Dave Hall playing the Two Mexican Dances, which was used as the episode closing music to the series Weeds, if you've ever seen that TV show. He now plays on a custom Damaro marimba, and he has a new line of mallets coming soon. You can read about that on his website, which I didn't know about. What's that? Sorry, Casey.
I was just wowing. That's great. I didn't know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So he's worked with Doug Damaro to develop these mallets. He's been described as the Rubinstein of all aspects of the marimba, which I think is one of the coolest quotes I've ever heard. And he was inducted into the PAS Hall of Fame in 2012. So a huge, huge figure in our field. And Alice, you were fortunate to study with Gordon at Ithaca during your master's degree, was it?
Yeah.
Could you tell us about that? Because I visited Ithaca 2 or 3 times when my friend Kate was studying there and loved every second with Gordon.
Oh, yeah. So, my story with Gordon can be traced back to when I was 13, I think. And he went to Taiwan and did a percussion summer camp, and I was the little girl there, play libertango for him and hit the last chord wrong. So he basically just laughed the whole time. But after that, he gave me his email, and then we keep sending email to each other and talking about music. And when I about to graduate from undergrad, I asked him if I can audition there. So I did audition and he really liked it. And after the 1 year that I took a break, he accepted me to Ithaca College. And while I studied there, I think the teaching style that Gordon had was really different from what I have been experienced in Taiwan. Because in Asia, when you learn from the teacher, it's kind of like a master teacher kind of style. So you basically have to listen to everything that the teacher told you and you have to do it the way that your teacher wants. So when I first moved into Ithaca and had the first lesson with him, I asked him, so what do you think I should play this phrase? And he said, well, play like Alice. So that's the first thing. And I was super confused because I'm like, I don't know how I would play it. Because usually people tell me how to play it. So that's that's a big, huge difference. And that's the thing that I learned a lot during the 2 years I was at IC.
Yeah, and I think it was in his PAS Hall of Fame write-up, Kevin Bobo gave a very nice quote about Gordon helps every student find their own individual voice. It's not that sort of dictation of what you have to do.
Yeah.
Ben, by the way, that was episode 15, Carly and 15. I went and found it. I know, but it does like, wow, we have Gordon Stout that soon? That's I'm very proud of us for getting someone like Gordon.
Well, and Alice mentioned playing Libertango for Gordon. One of the, it's cool to just to look back at history and see who was in the same room at the same time. The first Lee Howard Stevens competition in 1995 was the one where Gordon said in the final round it was a free repertoire selection. You could play whatever you wanted. And there was this young French kid that got up and played these four pieces he wrote called The Four Rotations. And it blew everyone's mind. And of course, that was Eric Smoot, and we know who he is today. But back then, he was absolutely nobody. and well, actually, that's not true. He was, I think, playing in the Paris Opera already. So maybe not quite a fair statement. but in the marimba world, he was unknown, I should say. And Gordon certainly helps make Eric Smoot's career what it is today with that victory.
So Alice, you were saying a little bit about finding your voice and developing, you know, your artistry as an individual. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like and how it developed in the years that you were studying at Ithaca?
Yeah. So at first, of course, I don't know what to do. And I was really struggled by what he said. And there's a short period of time, I think Gordon Stout is not a good teacher because he didn't tell me what to do. But after a while, I start to, well, he, in the first semester, he mentioned to make good sounds a lot. And by making sure that all the notes that you play, that's good sound, I kind of can feel how the music should go instead of just a lot of notes put in together. So after that, I start to think how I want my music to be instead of how this music should be.
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's such an important lesson, and we hear about that all the time, finding your voice and your teacher helping you have a voice and become a voice. And I know they talk, and we talked about it fairly recently, but if you tell someone something specific, like, you know, Ben tells me, hey, I have trouble with stage fright. What do you do to get over it? And I say, or what should I do to get over it? And of course, the natural response is to tell him what I do. But if he just does what I do, he may never actually discover the thing that he needs to make it work for him. So you have to be really careful. Like, self-discovery can be so, so valuable. So I think it's tricky. Like, just tell them exactly what to do. And a lot of times, I don't know if you guys feel like this, but in teaching, you know, sometimes I feel like, okay, hey, my dear student, you're doing everything right. Everything here is good. I don't have a lot to say. We have an hour, and really you just need to like do this, 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 and this more. That's it. Like, I don't want to overcomplicate what's going on, because the truth is you just need to do that for a lot longer and make it more automatic, do it and get really, really, really comfortable with it. But I think what we often try to do is we say like, oh man, I'm the teacher. If I don't fill this hour with tons of little tidbits of information and get like really, really specific, then the students, or I'm not doing my job, or the student's going to think I'm stupid. But really, like, what they might need is just some space. And in at least my percussion pedagogy class, what I try to do is talk about the role of the teacher and how you have to change to the coach. Because a coach in like an athletic situation, they're not always telling you how to do it or what to do. They're just like drilling you. So, okay, student's doing everything right. We got to keep working on this piece. We have an hour left. I'm just going to start drilling you and like asking you to do it over and over. And, you know, I don't know if you guys ever feel that way. And I've seen it in a master class too, you know, so the student plays something really, really well. And you can almost see the clinician gets this feeling of like, crap, that was really good. And I don't know what to say. And if I don't say something brilliant, everyone's going to think I'm stupid. So they just like kind of say something, you know, or whatever. Or they, if the student played the phrase up, they tell them to play it down or whatever. Like, they just like throw comments out when really they should probably just point out what was good about it. And they should probably ask, you know, prod the student for questions to be illuminating to the other audience members who are also players. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So much good stuff. So, Alice, my question for you is, what of maybe of that style of teaching have you taken into your own teaching style, and what have you incorporated?
Yeah, so asking a lot of questions is the thing that I learned from Gordon, because in our lesson, basically, we only play for the first, I don't know, 10 minutes-ish, and then he just asks a lot of questions. And but those questions are the things that's helping me try to figure out how I want the music to be and how I feel about the music, and help me do my own interpretation. So I do ask a lot of questions and try. I'm still trying, because I think my background of study in Asia is still having me sometimes still having me like tell people what to do instead of letting them the freedom to do so. So I'm still reminding myself to ask their question and help them to do what they want to do.
I think there's certainly a balance between, yes, it's not a bad thing to copy the master, so to speak, at times and try and emulate their style. And then other times, yeah, you do your own thing. But Alice, so you also studied with Gwen Dees, who obviously comes from the Robert Van Cise legacy, so to speak. And so with both Gwen and those sort of Van Cise pieces and Gordon and his own pieces, it's interesting because like there's such an established performance practice actually for relatively new repertoire here as to how should Dances of Earth and Fire sound, or how should Two Mexican Dances sound. Like when you studied with these master teachers on quote unquote their repertoire, how did you find your own voice within those pieces?
Well, when I think about that, when I'm learning a piece, I think about the composer a lot. Like, what's their style? What's their personality? Why they wrote the music like that? So I do learn from their playing. And if I know there's certain interpretation that they need, it's going to be there. But in this I'll do some stuff in this box that's a little bit different than other people. Does that make sense? So dynamic, if it's forte, and if Gordon's forte is always not that loud, but in that range I'm going to do a little bit of adjustment to fit how I feel about the music, that kind of thing.
Let's see, Alice, one other thing we can ask you about. I think you've had some really great experiences with competitions. Can you talk a little bit about the preparation and the actual competing part of the process?
So learning a lot of pieces and practice really hard, that's like the thing for competition. And for doing a competition, I learned to perform instead of trying to impress people during the competition. So I take competition as another performance instead of something different. So when I prepare for it, I learn the notes, I do all the interpretation, musical ideas that I want, and I also practice how it might feel like to be on the stage in the competition and prepare for that. And during the competition, I just trying to enjoy the stage.
Yeah. Do you find it hard to enjoy? Well, you probably don't, because you win so many things. I've heard of so many people who, because I feel the same way. Like when I'm going to perform, I need to enjoy the environment behind it. And speaking of stage fright, the thing I learned about myself is the way I feel really comfortable before getting on stage is try to joke with like the sound person or the stage crew or the other performers, and just like try to really, I don't know, just try to really surround it with positive laughter and just like, you know, some kind of joy. But is there anything we can tell to people who just find that environment so intimidating? You know, maybe they got on an international flight for the first time ever, and it's terrifying, all these people from other countries, and you hear them warming up in the other rooms, and you're like, holy crap, this person's already playing that piece, and that person's already playing that piece, and they're just like frozen, terrified. You know, I don't know, any advice of hope for them?
Yeah, so first of all, I also lose a lot before I win it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so entering a competition is not—it's not just thinking I have to win it. Take it as a learning opportunity and experience for you to overcome all of this kind of pressure. And when I did the Australia Marimba competition, I actually had an experience of listening to other people play in the room and freaking out. And I call Professor Dees Guan Dees, and she's the one who told me that you have already did so much, and you practiced, you sing through all the music, you do everything that you can do, and now you're there, another country, you just have to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. So when I did that competition, I actually didn't think I would have a chance to win, even get into the final round, actually. So I just decide to do whatever I did in the practice room and then bring it on the stage.
Right. What's Australia like? I have been, but I want to hear what you think it's like.
When I went there, so it was summer in the United States, but it was winter there, so it's pretty cold. And all I'm thinking about is going to the zoo, and there's super cute koalas. I really like it. Right. I wanna bring one home, but...
I missed the zoo. We had a car going to the zoo, and it wasn't convenient. But everyone came back, and they said that was the best thing that we did here. And so, like, so yeah, still
regret it. This reminds me. Sorry, I just have to interject. Like a weird thing. A while back, I think I was on the. I want to say it was the Black Swamp website, and they have a collaboration with some Australian company, and they are making tambourines with kangaroo skin heads.
Oh,
and wow. Apparently, wow. like it almost sounds like a joke, like you're killing like the national animal, but it's like a population control thing. Like they have to kill a certain amount of kangaroos, wow. And it's wasteful to not use their meat and not use their skin. So it's actually very sustainable. But yeah, I was just like, what am I reading? It's so weird.
I'm glad you said that, because we ate kangaroo. We grilled kangaroo meat while we were there. And one of the Australian students said, yeah, kangaroos are like rats here. Like they're dangerous. They're everywhere. And they're like pests, you know, they're like vermin. You know, I was really surprised to hear that. Wow. We think
so is kangaroo meat.
It's good. It's like really soft beef, you know.
I should get some of it. Cook it my sous vide for my next guest artist.
You should. Ben does this weird. It's so weird. It's good.
It's good though.
Yeah, I think you got Caleb into it. He mentioned it a few weeks ago. Said that's his next interest.
Yeah, but sorry, that was way off topic.
Yeah, we got way off. Go on. Yeah, way off the rail. Carly, you're the host. This is your responsibility.
Well, so, Alice, when you were in Australia, how many kangaroos did you kill?
I saw you just try, Carly. I heard you try to kill.
I made a good effort.
Good effort. Back on the rail.
Let's bring us back. No, speaking of competitions, one thing that came to mind was what's in your thought process, aside from let's enjoy the music and enjoy the performance, do you find it difficult not to think about who you're competing against or rankings or anything like that? And I assume what your goal is let's focus on exactly, like, let's enjoy this, let's make it as musical as possible.
Yeah, I do care about who my competitors are, so I just don't look, like, I didn't do any research of any of them, and I didn't do research of the panel, I didn't do research of anything. I just go there and then see what's going to happen.
I think that's smart.
Yeah, I'm sure
that's a little bit coward, but it's
no, that's I don't know. I think that's smart. I know people will say like you really need to research the like the committee or the panel and try to really get inside their, you know, like their heads and everything and really figure out what they want to hear, but that might be one thing if you're playing for like one person. I just don't even see that as practical with, because what do they have, three or four judges?
Well, and I mean, any good judge is going to know that, like, Robert Van Cise understands there are different good interpretations. Yeah. I don't think that anyone worth being judged by would be, oh, you can't play that piece that way.
Well, I've judged, I mean, you guys know I've judged a handful of these things, like local and international ones, and like, the judges I'm always with, I mean, we're always so different. Like, we're totally different. And it still means we can come together and figure it out. But if a player tried to do, if a player tried to play a piece a certain way to like appease any one of us, it would have been canceled out by like that appeasement either would have been negative for the other person or would have just been ineffective, you know, and just would have like, it would have been neutralized by the other judge's opinion. Sorry, Carly, I think you were saying something.
Yeah, I think it comes back to what we were talking about earlier with Gordon Stout encouraging Alice and all of his students to develop their own voice. Like we all accept, you know, differences in interpretations from our students, and we encourage that. And you know, for any one person, yeah, it's silly to think about. Like, of course, we want to please the judge to so we get chosen or whatever, but it's impossible. So I think it's smart. I think that's exactly what you want to do. Just walk in and be you, and hopefully they love it. And you know, it's something I'm thinking about a lot. A couple weeks ago, I was talking about goals, and one of the things I was talking about and I've been thinking about with my students a lot is we can't control the outcome of an audition or a competition. We can't control what the judge thinks. We can't control, you know, what the person judging the audition, what they're looking for. All we can do is control our preparation and to an extent control how it goes in the performance. You know, we always have surprises, but you can't try to guess what they're going to think and perform to that. You just have to be yourself and fall back on all the decisions you already made. You know, Casey, I think it's a good time for a little history.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I looked hard and not a lot happened on September 26th, which is when we're going to be releasing this episode. So I did find one cool thing, though, and that is the premiere of West Side Story, the musical. So on September 26th in 1957, the famous West Side Story was premiered. So you have the musical by Leonard Bernstein when he was 38, Words of Sondheim. And of course, this is the retelling of the famous Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet. And this opened in New York's Winter Garden Theater, and it ran for 734 performances and a year-long national tour, and then 249 more performances on Broadway, the last 9 months of which the drummer was somebody special who we talked about recently. I bet Ben knows who it is.
I was going to ask you that.
Oh, you're gonna...
I know Carly knows. I know Carly knows also. Let's see. Alice, do you know who it was, the original drummer for West Side Story?
No, I don't.
Michael Colgrass. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's cool. I did not remember that. But I do remember, I feel like I do remember you saying that. So that was really the only like big news thing I could find that happened on September 26th. I'm sure there are things, and there are all sorts of premieres and performances and things, but that was the only one that really struck me. But yeah, I found just some fun facts about West Side Story just while we're talking about it. And I pulled this from mentalfloss.com, which I'm sure probably pulled it from somewhere else as these articles tend to go, but I'll just read from there. After this daring musical made its Big Apple debut on September 26, 1957, critics reacted as if an atomic bomb had gone off over Manhattan. The next day, Walter Kern in the New York Herald Tribune wrote that the radioactive fallout from West Side Story must still be descending on Broadway. Theatergoers were stunned. There was an edgy, electrifying show with some of the boldest choreography ever staged, an emotional roller coaster from start to finish. So pretty cool. And a couple of lesser known facts you might not have known. And I'll just read a couple of them. Some of them I didn't think were worth saying, but just a few from the article. This was originally going to be a story and a conflict about a Catholic boy and a Jewish girl rather than two opposing street gangs. So this was something that they ultimately changed as they thought the like religious controversy was a little bit stale by now. So they went with something else and they didn't think it would be very, very controversial. They thought it was old news. And the Jets and Sharks were prohibited from interacting off stage. So the director, his last name is Robbins, tried to generate real hostility between these fictitious gangs. According to producer Hall Prince, the Broadway veteran kept both groups of actors as far from each other as possible. They were not allowed to socialize in the theater. They weren't even allowed to take their lunch breaks together. And they say, obviously, this was an extreme approach, but over time, it's started working, apparently. And it's funny, it reminded me of one of the actors from The Sopranos. And he was talking about a specific fight scene he had, the HBO series Sopranos. And I guess in this fight scene, which I don't remember, I have seen all of Sopranos, but I just didn't recall it so long ago. But they really fight. I mean, they really hit each other. They really, really get physical. And supposedly the director was saying, like, you guys don't have to, like, go that hardcore. Like, we can make this look real enough. But because they were such good friends, the two actors, they really were comfortable doing that. So I don't know. I mean, obviously, what the heck do I know? But that was an interesting choice. It seems like the counter would be better. Like, if you want people to be comfortable pretending to be hostile to each other, I feel like you actually need to have a whole lot of comfort. But this is, I mean, this is like the famous West Side Story. I would not know. What else? Four-letter words. So cuss words were replaced with unoffensive gibberish. So through West Side Story, lyricist Stephen Sondheim wanted the F-bomb to make its theater debut. Initially, this choice word appeared in the Officer Krupke song, but Columbia Records, which released their original cast recording, noted that using such language would violate obscenity laws and hence prevent the show from touring across state lines. Defeated, they went with, instead of fuck you, they said Krupke you, which is kind of the famous line and makes it much cuter than the real F word, of course.
Krupp, Officer Krupke.
Oh, yeah, Krupp, yeah. What did I say?
Krupp.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking of my son's cough. Krupp cough, which he doesn't have right now, but he had. That's what I was thinking. But yeah, thank you. Yeah, Krupke. Yeah, of course, Krupke. And the last little one I found was that Maria originally had a death scene written. So like the Shakespeare play, the two star-crossed lovers kill themselves. And originally, Maria was like also going to die. But apparently discussions, they said no, like she's already dead inside. And it's, you know, more tragic if one of them is alive. So anyway, that's what happened on September 26th. And also just some fun West Side Story trivia.
So I love West Side Story. And actually, yeah. Carly can vouch for this. When I was a student at Miami, I did my secondary area in conducting. And I got to do a rehearsal of the symphonic suite from symphonic dances from West Side Story. But one of the most fascinating things I discovered, and I love doing this, playing this in my music appreciation class. Do you guys know the tune Cool Fugue from West Side Story? Da 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 da, that one. Yeah. Do you know what compositional device Leonard Bernstein used in it?
Canon. I don't.
Nope. It's a 12-tone row.
Oh.
That famous little melody is a 12-tone row. And so in my music appreciation class, we do a little review of music history and we get up to 12-tone music and I play something by Schoenberg and nobody likes it and that's fine. But then I play this other thing and I say, so you guys like that one? And, you know, there's cool choreography by Jerome Kern and, you know, it's this like they're dance fighting, this awesome scene. And then I go, okay, well, that's also a 12-tone row. And I point out that's how he organized his material in that. So yeah, it's also a double fugue, as the name implies, cool fugue. But yeah, it's I love West Side Story in that. Cool Fugue is one of the coolest things ever, no pun intended. And then also, Carly and I, when we were students at Miami, we saw Svet and Gwen Deese perform a two-piano, two-percussion version of it, where there's basically a two-piano version of it, and they just sort of created two percussion parts based on the orchestra version of it. So, yeah.
It's cool.
Very cool. So, Alice, I wanted to make sure I wanted to make sure that we have time to ask you about your studies over the summer with Keiko Abe, which I'm sure must have been quite the experience. What was that like?
It's amazing. Well, so she gave lesson every Wednesday, and I literally cried every Wednesday because I was so touching by the thing that she told me. She's not only teach me music, she also teach me like a I don't know how to describe that, but it's a spirit rise thing. Like you feel your whole spirit is in a different level when you play with her. It's pretty cool.
Wow. We've had multiple people say that, like, there's playing with Keiko Abe, and then there are these things that are always outside. Like, I know there's the story, she had her phone number for every student, and there was an evening she'd set aside where she would sit by her phone at home, and she would say, any of you are welcome to call, but you have to, we're not going to talk about music.
Other than teaching a lesson, she doesn't really talk about music that much, but she talks about a lot of like life experience, and she encouraged young musicians a lot. And for a big person like her, she will sit down with you and have tea with you and order pizza, eating with you, and just talk about, you know, life things. It's an amazing experience. My life.
Mm-hmm. What did you, I mean, I assume it was like a traditional lesson, like you brought pieces to her, or did she evaluate your playing and then say, okay, I want you to play this piece of mine or that piece of mine? I mean, I think everyone goes to Keiko Abe. If you're going to go to Keiko Abe, it's to learn how to play Keiko Abe, right?
Yeah. So her lesson is like a master class every week. So she come into a school for 3 hours every Wednesday, and then you get to sign up lessons. So sometimes you can choose not to play, but you know, I already paid for it. I already have enough piece to play every week. And then you go and play for her, and there's a whole bunch of students sitting down there. And you can also see other students play, and she talks about it. And the cool thing is when she, when I took lesson with her, she didn't really talk or teach that much, but she'll just be like, hey, can I play with you? And then while we play together, you can feel her energy is like getting you through the music. It's really cool. I have never had that kind of experience. And being honest, before this summer, I think her music is cool, but it's a little bit, it's not deep enough. There's not too much of artistic stuff in it. But after this summer, it's totally changed because all of the things she wrote, all of the things she decided to put in the music mean something, and it's really cool.
Can you describe for us why it's important to play Keiko Abe, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think first, her music plays an important role in the history of marimba repertoire. So I do recommend all of my younger kids to play her music and learn how this developed. And another thing is, have you heard about ma in Japanese? This is a concept of like a space, pause. And by learning her music, you can see a lot of ma in her music. And then this is the thing that's in their culture or in like Asia culture. And that's the thing that Western people usually don't really notice, but if you learn the music, learn ma through her music, you can actually feel how the sections connect to each other, and you can kind of feel the concept of ma. And also her music is usually describing something. So it's easy for students to think about an interpretation based on the title, or think about how the music mean to the life experience.
If anyone's interested in hearing more about this, Nani Mamura talked about it on an older episode, and she gave a great class when I was in Italy with her, and this episode of our podcast somewhere way back when, her, Theodore Milkov, and Andrei Peshkorov were all just hanging out in a back room talking, and I recorded them, and I begged her to repeat some of her masterclass because I thought it was so profound in the way Alice is talking about, like just this concept of and it's a part of Buddhism. I think she used the word ma because it has so much to do with space. And she talked a lot about Japanese traditional painting. And I thought it was just, very, very, very informative. And especially to think about your performer's relationship to the audience and artist's relationship to the audience and the performer. And like a lot of cool utility there that you're right. Like we don't think about it. At least over here in the States, for sure.
I actually developed a clinic project based on what I learned from her this summer, and also through, I do a lot of Chinese painting, and so this clinic is about ma in music, but I use a lot of Asia painting to describe and to explain this concept to students. That's my new project.
Very cool. What's some of your favorite? No, okay. We've asked many guests this before. Favorite Keiko Abe piece. You have to pick one.
It's really hard.
You have to pick one.
I think
one.
It's the Wind Across Mountain.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I really like that one.
It's so good to hear all of this about Keiko Abe and her music, because I think sometimes like we hear, especially some of these pieces so often that they start to lose the novelty or lose the effect. But I think you're right. Like, what you're talking about, Alice, is going to make me hear everything in a new light. And that's so, so cool. Ben, I think you have something to share.
Yeah, I always have so many thoughts when it comes to Keiko Abe, and there have been so, so many wonderful comments about her on this podcast from especially Robert Van Sice, Norm Weinberg, and who's the other one I just had in my mind? I'm blanking out. Mike Rosen, that's the other one. And like to kind of go back to Casey's question of like, what can we get out of playing her instrument? It makes me think about how in the Steve Schick book, Steve Schick talks about as percussionists, we don't have an instrument, right? Like B.B. King played Lucille. He didn't play guitar. He played Lucille. His guitar has one guitar. And so often as percussionists, we walk up and we play whatever xylophone happens to be there. And Keiko Abe, Michael Rosen talks so much about how she has such a special relationship with the instrument. And it's, you know, even if she goes to a different Yamaha marimba each time, it's she has such a connection, a spiritual connection with that instrument. And I like a great like closing remark for Keiko Abe, I think, is from her PAS Hall of Fame article. And it's just a little quote I love to go back to every single time I think about her. She says, "I have great respect for the marimba. When I play, I have a great desire to find its expressive possibilities, knowing that at one time this most beautiful wood came from a living tree with its own history and experience. It is as if the marimba bar breathes like a living tree, and when I make music, I want to breathe with it." I think that's just so beautiful and profound.
And then she just breaks every bar.
No.
She plays so strong. That's great.
That's so beautiful. Well, Alice, I have one more question for you, similar to the way that we're talking about the concept of ma and Keiko Abe's music. I'm wondering if you can talk just a little bit about, I saw on your website a few pieces that you've written that were inspired by ancient Chinese stories. Can you talk about that influence in your own music?
Yeah. So all of this has come from, I have a cousin. He's a Chinese opera singer. And it's really, he's really special because all of the role that he sings is girls. But he's a man. So he really liked this kind of culture, and I started to listen to the music and go to the Chinese opera with him. And I really like how their body language on the stage. Like, the Chinese opera is very different from the Western opera. Western opera usually is very straight. If you open the door, you open the door. But in Chinese opera, when you open the door, it might take 10 minutes for them to open the door. So that's really cool. But all the motion that they have are really pretty. So my first piece that with the Chinese opera is based on an ancient story about how a girl like a guy, but she's weak and about to die, so she can be with this guy. And this is a pretty story, and I wrote the percussion part, and my cousin act on that. And that was a really cool experience, because I found out that I can actually bring this traditional art to people with this Western new music style, to have people accept this art that's about to fade away. So then I wrote another one that has a lot of fighting and rhythmic stuff. That's the one that's on my website. Mm-hmm. And then that's the one that has three movement, and I actually bring that to Ithaca College, and we had a percussion ensemble to perform it in New York, which is really cool, and people liked it. So I think this is a way for me to connect the Western, my Chinese background and Western education together to people, and then bring this bring this stuff that's not a lot of people interested in anymore to in a different way to let people accept.
And you are from Taiwan, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I you mentioned my student Kai Po, and when you said bring Chinese culture to Western art music, Kai's done such a great job doing the same thing. Like, when in percussion ensemble, he always wants to play Lou Harrison, he always wants to play John Cage, but every semester he's got something from Taiwan or from somewhere in China that I've never heard of and do not know. And it's
so much Asian influence in both Harrison and Cage anyway. That
I know, right? Yeah. Anyway, yeah, for sure. But I was going to ask, how do you know Kai Po from Taipei or from?
I think we both were in the percussion educational system.
Yeah.
So, and also Taiwan is like this little. And right. There's this little percussionist there. So we kind of know each other. Like, we kind of know everyone.
Okay. I sort of figured, but yeah, you said his name specifically. I thought that was pretty cool. Yeah. That's all. Yeah. Great.
Well, Alice, that's really nice to think about, too. We've kind of had this running theme today, talking about finding your voice and what do you have to offer the world as a musician. And it's so great for you that you're exposing people that might not know anything about Chinese opera to this art form. And it's special and unique and just very cool that you're doing that. So thank you. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, it's been so great chatting with you. Thank you very much for everything today. We've had a great time, and we'll see you hopefully at PASIC.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Thanks.